Hello, and welcome to Community Forum. I'm Ellen Lockyer. Today we'll be talking about fires, in particular interface fires between suburban areas and wild woods. We have a lot of areas in the Anchorage Bowl, Mat-Su, where there's fairly dense housing pushing into predominantly wild areas. And the fire danger is always there, especially with the long month or so of hot, dry weather we've had here. My guests today are Sue Rodman, she's a forester, and Jennifer Collins, who is an education specialist. They both are with the Anchorage Fire Department's Wildfire Mitigation Project. Hi.
Hi. Thank you for having us.
Welcome to Community Forum. So let's start the ball rolling. I'm going to ask Sue, what exactly is the definition of brush fire versus wildfire?
Well, much of that will come from our geographic area. And being that we're in a structural fire department, we're going to call things brush fires upon initial attack because they're going to be starting in vegetation. They'll be rolling through grass, maybe getting into trees. And if we compare that to some of the larger fires up in the interior of Alaska or even Caribou Hills, Homer, Alaska, etc., that would be more of a wildfire situation because it has gone beyond the little brush fire that can be controlled on initial attack. Now it's something much larger that takes a lot more resources to suppress.
Mm-hmm. And a lot more resources provided by the city of Anchorage? Is that the...
Well, here in the Anchorage municipality of Anchorage, we have the Anchorage Fire Department that responds to the Anchorage Bowl and portions of Eagle River. And then beyond that, we have the Chugiak Volunteer Fire Department and the Girdwood Volunteer Fire Department. And then, so what will happen is when a brush fire is called out over our dispatch, Anchorage Fire Department will be the first responders there. If we need assistance, if it gets bigger, then we'll call in mutual aid resources, and that means the state of Alaska comes in next. And then we might also ask assistance from Bureau of Land Management, Alaska Fire Service.
Wow. Well, I'm just going to point out to our listeners that it can happen here. There was a fire in Homer early in May, took out three houses, and there is the Broken Snowshoe Fire, took out 25,000 acres or something across the river from McGrath, but uncomfortably close to McGrath. And there have been examples of such fires. In 1973, I believe, there was a fire on the O'Malley Road on the hillside area, which became very dangerous. And, of course, the famous Miller's Reach fire in Big Lake I believe, 96, which did a lot of damage to a lot of structures. So how does the fire department monitor fire danger, fire safety, say, in a densely populated area such as O'Malley, the hillside, Stuckagan Heights?
Well, we have, within the Wildfire Mitigation Office, we have good connection with our structural side, and we have what's called fire weather stations, and there's four of them that Anchorage Fire Department owns. In addition to that, we use one from the military and one through the city. And so there's six total fire weather stations throughout the area. We report those fire weather indices onto the Alaska Interagency Coordination Center up in Fairbanks. All of that gets translated into one place where it's compiled. We can go to that site, look at all of our weather, as well as the forecast from the Weather Service, and we can pick up yesterday's data and the previous day's data and give a good a forecast, if you will, for today on fire danger. So we look at all kinds of the Canadian fire weather indices.
Wow. We had some beautiful, unseasonably early warm weather starting in late April and stretching all the way through the last week of May. Did that sort of set up the summer as a danger summer?
It's hard to say it's going to set up the whole summer.
Yeah. Every summer we have at least a period of time with a pretty high wildfire danger. And this summer is certainly no exception. From talking to our fuel specialists at the fire department, the dry out of the fine fuels was faster this year. That's the grass and the duff layer is what we call it, but it's the 6 or 7 inches of grass on the ground. It would have dried out anyway, but the very quick warm-up probably contributed just to it drying out a little quicker. But every May we have the risk of wildfire definitely increases pretty significantly within that month.
I'd like to get to some of the causes of fires. I know that in the unpopulated areas, say the forests of the interior, it's pretty much lightning strikes that does it. But what about urban areas?
Well, we've got a lot of folks who want to get rid of some of their brush or debris around their homes. So whether they do it through our permitting system or on their own, outside of our permitting system, there's an opportunity there for brush fires to extend beyond their designated perimeter, especially if the wind comes up or it's not an approved burn day and they haven't called in. That's one place. There's all kinds of things that can happen if someone is sharpening something on an anvil and, you know, there's sparks flying. That's another opportunity for sparks to get in the dry grass. There are illegal camps that might be a source and has been in the past.
Illegal campfires, you mean?
Yeah.
People
mm-hmm.
leaving smoldering campfires.
Yeah, and then also, you know, there's children playing or other people playing in the woods, and they start fires, and they don't recognize that, you know, without dousing that fire out completely, those embers still have a chance to ignite some fuel.
Wouldn't that be some common sense? But I guess fire moves, I think, a lot more quickly than people are going to give it credit for. Like you were mentioning that a spark could set off a fire. I know there was Jen, you mentioned a fire earlier that was set by a spark. The Caribou Hills fire a couple of years ago did a lot of damage in Kenai, and it was some guy sharpening a tool outdoors.
Right.
And what is the likelihood of such a fire happening, say, in Anchorage in a populated area? I'm not talking about the central core of Anchorage. I'm talking about the areas outside, the hillside, Stuckagan Heights, O'Malley, that area.
Well, that likelihood will depend totally on the weather and what the dryness of the fuel is going to be like. So it's really a day-to-day call, and sometimes it's a couple days call. And if you're talking about, well, what is the bigger picture, what's the likelihood, let's go back to where we live. We live in Alaska at the southern extent of the boreal forest, and plain and simply, it burns. It will burn. It always has burned. It's going to burn again. And whether or not we're here to start that fire or there's some other force that does it, the boreal forest burns. So the fuels that are here, and I'm talking about the forest cover types and the grass and the vegetation, they're all very conducive to burning.
So forest fires, as a matter of course, it's normal for forests to burn. That is something that is, I think, programmed into the health and the growth of the forest. But now that people are building their homes in the forest, so to speak, there is an increased danger of that forest catching fire, or what?
There's an increased chance of ignition.
Ignition. Explain ignition.
Right. Well, ignition. Any spark could turn into an ignition. And just to give you an idea, just this year, since April 15th, which is what the state defines as the start of wildfire season, we've had 53 brush fires called in to the Anchorage Fire Department. And that's a little under 50 days. So they're happening, whether they're large enough for anybody besides the surrounding, you know, immediate area to know or not. We do have very frequent fires this time of year.
And you say brush fires. Would these be from illegal campfires, perhaps?
Some of them were. We had one fire, a one-acre fire in Russian Jack Park that the investigator determined it was started in the vicinity of an illegal campsite. We're not sure if it was actually a fire or some other ignition source, like a lantern or possibly a discarded cigarette. But those fires start for any number of reasons. Like Sue mentioned, children playing with fire, we see that every year. It's something that our investigators are very aware of. And we have multiple reasons why they start.
So how about legal fires in camping and recreation areas? You say illegal fires. Is there a legal fire, like cooking campfire?
Sure, yeah.
Rally around the campfire and sing
that
kind of thing.
And we allow that. Okay. On approved burn days within some guidelines, and we have to establish guidelines because there's a lot of us living here. So when you get your burn permit, there's a whole section on what is a cooking or recreational fire in your yard that you don't need a permit for, but you still need to make sure it's an approved burn day. You can still use your chimnea. those kinds of things are allowed here. We just have some guidelines for people to follow to stay safe.
How about, okay, like I have a gas grill in my backyard. Just you turn on the, with a little propane tank, and you turn on the knobs. And, you know, I always keep a hose nearby, just in case. Does that pose a danger in dry areas, dry days, dry seasons?
I would say the one danger that a grill could cause would probably only come from a charcoal grill if someone dumps out the coals. Mm-hmm. But one thing I just wanted to add, Parks and Recreation is going to be placing signs in the parks reminding people that campfires are not allowed in parks, and that is mainly in due to part that there's a lack of water source. There's no one has a hose nearby to put that out. So what Sue is saying is you can have campfires in your own yard, cooking, what's considered a cooking or a recreational fire or a chiminea or an outdoor fireplace, one of those 12 inches off the ground with a screened lid, manufactured fireplaces that you can buy at most of the larger stores in town. Those are allowed, but those are treated very similar to grills. So I think propane grills are probably not much of an issue unless you're using them incorrectly. Grossly and
maliciously.
Yeah, there was.
And then in addition to the city parks, there's camping out in Chugach State Park. Mm-hmm. And while they are under the jurisdiction of the Division of Forestry for Fire Suppression, we maintain good contact with them. We talk to them. If there's a couple days of high fire danger, we'll be talking and we'll suggest that they don't allow campfires out in the wildlands of the park. And we have, I think, a really good relationship with them, and they're able to work with us on being safe around here.
Let's get back to brush fires for a minute. Sue, we were talking earlier about a fire about a year ago. It was in Midtown Anchorage. It was scary. I remember seeing the plume of smoke. Do you remember the Piper Street fire?
Piper Fire, July 2nd last year. We had quite a bit of rain in June. We all remember that, maybe not so fondly. And what we were talking about earlier is those upper layers of the soil, the litter, the grass, the leaves, it was all really moist. And then we had 3 days of drying, end of June, 1st of July, and it was significant drying. So all those leaves, the grass dried out. And because there was an ignition source in that place at the right time, that was unattended, that fire was able to grow. And that's what caused the growth of this Piper Fire. Came into 10 acres. We had to call in Division of Forestry. We had our contract helicopter, all of our Anchorage firefighters there. Division of Forestry came with another helicopter and a retardant plane. We had BLM smoke jumpers there.
Wow.
It was quite a scene.
Yeah, you had quite the wildfire right there in the middle of Anchorage. And that is scary. And
yeah,
it's very scary because so many of us would be affected by somebody else's negligence.
Yeah, and we were so lucky that day because there was effectively no wind. Had there been any wind, we were in Black Spruce and it could have moved quickly. And it could have really traveled through far north by Centennial, impacting folks along Dowling, the Elmore Road there, Brigaw Extension, up into Muldoon. You know, there's a number of ways where it could have impacted homes directly, not to mention those folks directly north of that, just by a few hundred feet along Grumman.
Mm. So some of the causes, we have pretty much established that many of these wildland interface forest fires and brush fires are human cause, human error, human incompetence, human foolishness, who wants to name it. But what are some of the things homeowners can do to protect their homes? You know, if, say, the neighbor is burning brush on a windy day, I mean, let's get at some of the mitigation efforts that we could make.
I would say the most important thing first is that if they see some smoke, they call 911 to call it in. That's just something that you can do to make sure that if there is a fire, that you call 911 immediately. So that's just that's more of a safety thing. The second thing is a more of a proactive approach would be to create defensible space, make your home firewise, is the national term that it's referred to. That just means removing anything within a certain distance from your home that has the potential to ignite in such a way that your home would ignite because of it. A lot of people, when they picture homes igniting from wildfire, they picture those scenes in California when there's a brush moving up a hill and it's igniting and you see a wall of flames and that hits the homes and the homes are burned down from literally from flame impingement. But what happens a lot more often that we don't hear so much about because it's not nearly as exciting is just embers. Embers dropping into areas near the home and igniting things that might be touching the home, like a pile of firewood or spruce trees touching your house. Mm-hmm. So creating defensible space is a way to reduce the amount of material that's touching your home that can burn.
You often see pictures of rustic Alaska homes with the firewood piled on the front porch. Not a good idea.
At least not after April 1st.
Okay. I would like to take a short moment here to remind our listeners this is a call-in program. And if you have any questions for our guests, Jen Collins or Sue Rodman, and they are both with the Anchorage Fire Department's Wildfire Mitigation Project, please call 550-8433. 550-8433 or 1-888-353-5752, 1-888-353-5752 outside the Anchorage area. Or you can email us at communityforum@kska.org. So I have lots of questions. Let's talk a little bit about defensible space. Who wants to field that?
I'll give it a shot. So the programs that we have to directly help homeowners, help is probably the easiest way to say it. We do home assessments for people. So we go to their homes once they've applied for it, if they live in an area that does have a risk for wildland fire, and we go to their homes and we tell them what they can do to reduce the chances that their home's going to burn. So that's creating defensible space. And the general idea of what we do is any spruce tree is what we're worried about. I guess hemlock could also fall under that, but any conifer tree with needles within 15 feet we recommend for removal. And in addition, things like you mentioned, firewood piles, also we recommend moving those 30 feet away from the home. Fuel canisters, people like to store them outside of their house for ease when they're mowing their lawn. We recommend those are preferably in an exterior shed is the best place to put those, in a storage shed that's more than 30 feet from their home. We also give people advice like for maintenance, remembering to clean your gutters, to get the leaves and needles out of your gutters, and keeping your lawn mowed short. One thing, and I think Sue and I have both mentioned this, is there is a wild grass, the wild reed grass, that is prevalent everywhere in South Central Alaska, especially in places where there has been trees that have died and been removed for some reason. So obviously with the beetle kill, you see a lot of this reed grass, and it's called calamagrosis. And when this calamagrosis dies and lays over, it becomes, you know, a layer of very thick, extremely volatile. It can burn very fast. And so people have that on their properties because they've had spruce trees that have gone down, or the grass just occurs there naturally. So we talk to people about how to maintain that and remind them that is too a fuel. It's not just grass that doesn't burn. And we just make general recommendations for a lot of maintenance that people can do too.
Go ahead. Oh, I was going to add to that. Creating the defensible space, one of the key objectives there is to reduce the potential for your structure to start on fire when there is a brush fire. So I want to preface that by saying we can have fire in Anchorage. We can have it in our residential areas. We don't have to lose homes. If we're prepared and understand what to do before a fire strikes, meaning every year our maintenance, as Jen was talking about, and how to handle a fire when it occurs, then we can save our homes and our lives and still have a community here. The other thing that defensible space does is it buys us a little bit of time. So when fire, let's take the extreme worst scenario. This is not very likely. Let's say fire is traveling through the treetops. This is called a crown fire. Not very likely takes all the planets to align to have this happen. But when it does, as we saw in Miller's Reach, it's moving quickly. There's wind going. It's moving all these embers. That gives us a little bit of time to get out of the way, you know, to protect that home. We don't want to be anywhere near this fire when it's coming through, but, you know, whether it's a shaded fuel break or defensible space in your yard, there's space, meaning not fuel, where the fire isn't going to be able to burn. Fire needs fuel, so it's going to stop where the fuel doesn't exist anymore, and it's going to go some other direction, or it's going to come down on the ground where it might have just a little bit of fuel and it can kind of tootle around.
All right, so it's up to the homeowners to make sure there is no fuel around the perimeter of the house for how many? 30 feet, you say?
Well, what's called the home ignition zone, and this is about a 100-foot radius from the home. That's what we focus on primarily. However, there is no area within that home ignition zone that we say you need to have everything cleared. The 15 feet, the first 15 feet around the home, we recommend removing all coniferous, all spruce trees. But within that area, people can have lots of vegetation. They can have birch trees, alder, flower gardens, rock gardens are great. A lot of people have ponds and other hardscape features. So in that 15-foot, we want it as defensible as possible, like Sue was saying, and also defensible for our firefighters. So if they need to come in there, it's safe for them to approach that home and provide some structure protection in the event, maybe before a wildfire hits.
How about fire-resistant vegetation? Is there such a thing? I keep hearing that you can buy certain plants.
If it's dry, it could burn.
Not that fire-resistant.
But some plants have more moisture and characteristics that we recommend over other plants. You don't want to have a moonscape. So, like what Jen was saying, you can have all kinds of beautiful flowers and plants in your yard. Yeah, and it just takes some maintenance. You know, clear up the dead leaves and dead plant parts that are going to accumulate throughout the course of the summer. Clean those out regularly. Keep your plants watered. Don't use any kind of coniferous plants within your 30-foot defensible space zone. So that means like junipers or those really small, cute, ornamental spruce trees. Put those outside of that 30-foot perimeter. Focus on perennials, flowers, and herbs that are going to stay moist and have less of a chance to burn. We don't want you to use wood mulch in that zone either. You know, you use that wood mulch outside of that zone. And there's all kinds of compromises you can make and still have a beautiful yard.
So you don't have to put in a moat.
Don't need a moat.
Right.
Although it wouldn't hurt.
A little fish pond would be good. How about the role of the developers? Because, like shake roofs, you see a lot of wooden structures going up. They're very elaborate, very, very lovely, lots of natural wood, sort of California style. But they've got these shake roofs, cedar shake roofs, cedar siding. Good idea, bad idea?
Bad idea. There are cedar shake simulated
composite.
Yeah, whether it's Hardy Board or some other manufactured product that you can have something that looks just like a cedar shake, but it doesn't function like one. So the role of the developer, the role of the homeowner is to understand and take responsibility where you live. You need to know what your hazards are. Some covenants within homeowners associations require cedar shake roofs. And we've had lots of good constructive conversations with those folks, and they recognize the fire danger that they are imposing upon themselves by having this large ember-receptive bed right on top of their house. And that's the kind of thing that we'll have a really hard time suppressing if it starts on fire.
How about insurance? I mean, are there special... I don't know. This is maybe getting off topic a little bit, but would that be a question for insurance companies?
We did work with State Farm pretty extensively a few years ago, and a little bit with Horace Mann. We took them out, showed them what we do on a Firewise home assessment, gave them all of our materials that we use to educate homeowners, and they implemented that here in Anchorage and the Matsu Valley and up in Fairbanks. And I am not sure if they did it in other parts of the state. But then they sent that material to their policyholders, did a drive-by, so like a windshield survey, and very, you know, roughly, and to their credit, they took the time to do this. But then if someone was dramatically out of compliance, they sent them a letter on how to take part in the local programs that they could become more FireWise. And, you know, I think there were only two people who didn't comply in the whole of Anchorage. But so good for them for helping to make people safe and take responsibility.
Right, and it's all about taking responsibility for your own home, because it is your biggest investment, and more so, you know, everybody thinks of money, homes in terms of money, but home is where your heart is. Home is where you are. That's your little castle, so you don't want to take too many chances with it. I wanted to point out that to our listeners that you can get any information about today's show on our website, KSKA.org. And if you are, can go to the municipal website, they have a FireWise self-assessment sheet with little check boxes and different things you can do to make sure your house is safe and in compliance with what is the current viewpoint on fire safety. I wanted to talk a little bit about we talked about property management. We talked about the role of wildlands, the ignition. How about getting out? What if there is a fire in a densely populated area, say on the hillside, that area? Are people expected to have an evacuation route? How does that work?
I think the most important thing for residents to know is that if they see fire approaching their area, they should take their family and depart. There might not be time for an evacuation notice. And that's another point of preparedness for the homeowner, is know several ways out of your neighborhood and out of the greater neighborhood to make sure that you can, whether it is get off the hillside or get out of the Eagle River Valley, some of those places where transportation is limited.
And, well, I was going to say, it again is up to the owner of the home to be aware and to prepare. Most, you know, people move in. You don't move into a house with the idea that it's going to burn down someday. But every homeowner should have a plan of what to do, who to contact, and how to get out of the house, and teach their children that, too. So we are approaching, let me say once again, this is a call-in show, and I'd like to remind our listeners, if you have a question for either of our guests or a comment, please call 550-8433, 550-8433, or 1-888-353-5752. 1-888-353-5752, or email us at communityforum@kska.org. And you can go to KSKA's website, which is www.kska.org, for further information on our show today. Our topic is wildfires in the Anchorage Bowl. And I think it's about time to take a break. So you are listening to Community Forum on KSKA. We'll be right back.
The Anchorage Fire Department is a nonprofit client of KSKA, a financial contributor to KSKA's programming.
KSKA call-in programs are recorded and rebroadcast that night. In the evening, calls are not accepted.
Welcome back to Community Forum. I'm Ellen Lockyer. We're talking about wildfire mitigation today. My guests are Sue Rodman and Jen Collins, and they are both with the Anchorage Fire Department's Wildfire Mitigation Project. We were talking a little bit before the break about, things homeowners could do to keep their house fire safe. We talked about the role of the weather. And we talked about maybe the design of houses. Maybe a lot of woodwork on top isn't a great idea. Let's talk a little bit about just how fast a fire moves. Sue, would you like to talk us about rates of spread?
Yeah, I want to say something with respect to our fuel specialist. He's not with us today, but Jason Kohler is the fuel specialist for the department, and he also runs the aviation program, and he manages the helicopter contract. But Jason does a lot of work on analyzing fuels on a day-to-day basis. Earlier I talked about the fire weather stations. He tracks all that data. Jen works with the public, and I'm kind of behind the scenes, so we all have our respective roles. But here, Jason puts together every day kind of a prediction or a forecast of what today's fire behavior could be in Anchorage. And when we get into our typical boreal forest, we've got spruce trees, grass, birch trees, all kinds of different plants, and the weather that's accumulated so far, he'll put all that data into a software program called Behave, and he'll get some rates of spread and flame lengths. So today, if we take a head fire, so a fire that's moving forward through one of our typical spruce stands here in Anchorage that has birch in it, it might move as fast as 10 feet per minute. Well, we can walk a lot faster than 10 feet per minute, but if it's moving at 10 feet per minute across a couple of hundred feet, that's another story. If we get a wind on that, then we've got a real challenge for firefighters. Also, flame length. So if that flame, the height of those flames going through that forest, today it's predicted it could be as high as 7 feet in that open spruce stand or up as high as 13 feet in a closed, very tight black spruce stand, for example. That's way beyond any safety level that we can manage on the ground. So our Anchorage firefighters wouldn't be able to address that fire head on. They'd have to come in from the back, sides, and flank of that fire. We would be dependent on air resources, like a helicopter or a retardant plane, to address the head of the fire whenever they exceed 4 feet.
Wow. That's pretty impressive, though. And you were mentioning earlier about the Piper fire where BLM was actually called in with smoke jumpers. And, you know, it's not funny, though. The cost. What is the cost of something like that? The cost to the public, the cost of the tax? Well, every fire is different, but
thousands, you know, yeah. Tens of thousands, right. Hundreds of thousands of dollars. It's interesting, if you look at the cost now compared to the 1973 Hillside Fire that burned out of O'Malley, that was 200 acres. Mm-hmm. BLM had primary fire response at that day. A good friend of mine was first on site, and he was the incident commander there. Then they called in, Anchorage provided support that was out of their jurisdiction at that time. They were mutual aid, I guess, to BLM. But if you add in all the Anchorage Fire Department engines and firefighter personnel that helped there, $9,000. They tracked it all. Amazing. But
that was 1973.
That was 1973.
Right. I have a few notes on that O'Malley fire in May of 73. It started out as a small brush fire at a private home. The winds picked up to 40 miles an hour, burned out of control in the foothills of the Chugach Range. The fire threatened 25 homes, forced several families to evacuate, and ended up blazing 300 acres of brush and timber. And that was when there were very few people, actually. The hillside was hardly anyone there. And by today's standards, though, those are practically suburban tract housing now, with trees. And the damage could be substantial. And Jen, you were about to jump in there.
One little note about cost was the total cost of our aerial resource, our helicopter, our suppression helicopter, is less than the cost of one home, an average home in an area that could have a fire. So when you're talking about money, yes, it's expensive to suppress these fires, but when you compare it to the cost of replacing a home, or, you know, not to even mention a life or, you know, people's safety, the cost to suppress it is actually not that high. And the FireWise education programs that we offer to people, the education portion is free. You know, it doesn't cost anything to go out in your yard and cut your grass and water and do the maintenance that we ask people to do. So I think money is always an issue. Money is, you know, it makes things run. But we look at it from a more of a prevention standpoint and the cost effectiveness of doing things proactively before something starts.
You've touched on proactive, and I was going to get to that. The role of the homeowner, the role of the public, the role of the people in the community to look to their safety. And, you know, the fire department is there to help and to put out fires, but they need help, too. They need people to put their minds to work to try to prevent an event of that nature from happening. And what is the attitude? Do you get public attitudes of apathy, like, oh, you know, the fire department will take care of it if something happens? I mean, what is the role? I know that's changing, because since there was a terrible fire several years ago in California in which 5 firefighters were killed, and as it turned out, it was about 90 miles from L.A., and it turned out the home they were defending, first of all, was vacant. And the second of all, they got trapped. And since then, there has been maybe a shift in attitude to who's responsible. Who's responsible for defending a home? Can you comment on that?
I run into only a few homeowners, really, that say, if it burns down, I've got insurance. Very few. How about you?
Not too many people are completely apathetic. However, there is the slight misinformation that some people might have in their heads is, you know, they're used to, we have an excellent fire department, and when you call, you can expect that we'll be there in less than 4 minutes. And what people forget is that during a wildfire, your whole neighborhood is going to need help in less than 4 minutes. And so the attention that we give might not be what people are expecting. It might not be, you know, Sue was mentioning things, safety. When safety comes into, if there's a home that is not safe for us to approach and it's already on fire, this is during a wildland fire event, we're not going to put firefighters' lives at risk for that. So I think it's just it's all the scope of what would be happening is how it would affect us. But people, I think, just don't realize how large it could be and how tied up our resources might be.
And people can be just unaware of, you know, you think, well, this is just a little pile of twigs, and you're not really thinking the larger implication of this little burning pile of twigs could spread and take out the houses on each side of you. Let's go to the phones. We have a call from Carolyn, please, on line 2. Hi, Carolyn.
Hi. Yes, I have a question regarding what to do with underbrush that we're cleaning up in a remote area. I have a cabin on one of the lakes that's close to Big Lake, and the only way it's accessible is either by boat in the summer or by snow machine in the winter. And we're making an effort to clear dead trees and a lot of the underbrush, but there really isn't a very effective way to remove that, short of burning. And there's, you know, currently the last couple of years there have been bans on burning in that area. So what's a reasonable suggestion for dealing with that, the brush, to clear it up and get it taken care of so it's not sitting there in a pile for a fire?
Well, Carolyn, this is Sue, and first of all, we aren't in your area, so we only operate within the municipality of Anchorage, but through our partnerships with the Division of Forestry and Matsu Borough, it would make sense that you have a couple of alternatives, and one of them is, I'm assuming what you're saying here is that it's hard to get the brush off of your property because of its remoteness. So burning might be an option for you, but here's an opportunity for you to do a little pre-planning and burn in the fall when it's safer and it's moist. You can collect your brush now away from your home, pile it, put a piece of plastic over it to keep a portion of it dry, and this fall, when it's more moist, or this winter after it starts snowing, you can still have a dry portion of that pile to ignite and then take care of it at that time. If you do have an opportunity to get it off your property, there are a number of woodlots or brush receptive sites throughout the Mat-Su borough, but they are going to be your best resource there as to when they're open and where they're located.
Okay, thanks.
Thanks for calling, Carolyn. And that brings up my pile of brush in my backyard that stayed there all last summer because it was too wet to burn. And now I'm finding out there is no more open burn in Anchorage. What is the procedure to get a burn permit in this city?
So I want to clarify some terminology.
Okay, good.
It's a very good conversation we had. So the open burn ordinance is what we're operating under. And this was written in the early 80s, and there are some issues with it that we can improve upon. What we allow now is a burn permit system where our burn permits are free. They're online. You can get them over the phone, but you need to have a physical copy on site. They're issued through the fire department. We want you to help us be compliant with our air quality and fire danger. And if you follow the rules that we've set up and the guidelines, then we can continue burning, even with our increased population. So by burning spruce and not leaves and brush and alder and birch in our yards, we're burning drier material that gives off less smoke. When you start burning leaves and grass, it's a lot of smoke. It impacts our air quality. That's when we are going to be facing issues like no more burning in Anchorage.
Okay.
So let's keep it allowed.
So it's an air quality thing, not a fire danger thing so much. I cannot cover my little brush pile with plastic and torch it come November. I have to go to where? A woodlot or the dump? Tell me about the woodlots.
There's three woodlots within the municipality. Two of those are run by the Anchorage, by the fire department, specifically our wildfire division. So if you live in Eagle River or in the Turnagain Arm, you can go to the Girdwood Woodlot or the Eagle River Woodlot, which is located at the Highland Road location of the landfill, and deposit your brush. And if you live in Anchorage, you can go to 100th Avenue and C Street, and the Anchorage Soil and Water Conservation District runs a woodlot there. And you can bring your brush there or to the central transfer station.
Okay. The call board's lighting up. Let's go to Jeannie on line one, please. Hi, Jeannie.
Hi. My question has to do with the FireWise program. I believe in the past that there were some funds that were available once the assessment is done and they tell you which trees you need to remove, that there were funds available to help pay for that. Is that happening this year?
Hi, Jeannie. This is Sue. Yes, those funds are still available. And what we do is Jen talked about the FireWise Home Assessment Program. And for homeowners to apply online and get a FireWise Home Assessment, they can do that pretty quickly. We'll respond back and set up an appointment with the homeowner. Then we will recommend those trees to be removed on your property. And we'll give you a site prescription for your home. And that will designate which trees should be taken out and other things that you can do to make your home FireWise. Now, if you follow the program all the way through and get the trees removed, we'll reimburse you for 70% of the cost. But it is prorated on the per acre basis, so it's up to $2,000 an acre. So if you have a half an acre, we'll only give you the prorated portion of that.
And you can get that FireWise self-assessment rundown. It's got a lot of questions on how far away trees are from your house. What's your general landscaping? Do you have piles of stuff? That's available on the city website. You can get all the information you need on this program at kska.org. That's KSKA's website. You can go there and find out how to access all of these websites. I'd like to remind our listeners that this is a call-in, so call us at 550-8433, 550-8433, or 1-888-353-5752, or email us at communityforum@kska.org. And just reminding our listeners that this program is recorded in the afternoon. It airs again tonight at 10. Please do not call at 10 o'clock. There will be no one here to answer the phone. We have talked about just about everything I can think, but I want to talk a little bit about the impacts of devastating fires. The biggest example I can think of in recent years is the Miller's Reach Fire in 1996 out by Big Lake. And that happened in June, and it started, we never really figured out how it started, but it burned more than 37,000 acres and took something like 400 structures, yeah, at a cost of more than $15 million. And it was one of the events that forced the state and the city to take a good look, a good hard look at wildland interface fires, which is what they were calling them at the time. Because previous to that, I don't think, you know, people had really, our populations in those areas were so sparse that there was not a major danger to multiple houses from a fire out of control. And what have we learned from that? Can either of you comment on what we've been learning over the past years from other states, from other fires in other states, and the fires that have happened in Alaska?
Well, that fire really was the impetus for the Anchorage program to begin, along with the program on the Kenai Peninsula. And knowing that there were some opportunities to prepare your home and prevent structural loss or minimize that potential for structural loss, that's where the federal funds came in. And that's how this program was initiated in 98 through Project Impact funds. In fact, the Video Center, as part of the fire department, was started through that. They prepared that documentary called Northland Wildfires Lessons Learned. That won a national award for how it portrayed fire and brought in all the science and people and the real life on the ground situations that we face here in Alaska.
Yeah, and I remember I was here in Anchorage then. It was very scary. Even in Anchorage, the sky was just black for days. It impacted people who had respiratory problems. It was very frightening. And I think there was, you mentioned earlier crown fires where the treetops throw out embers in the wind and that pushes the fire forward. And, you know, 400 homes were lost, and they were predominantly smaller cabins in the Big Lake area. And many of those homes were not insured, and which added, of course, to the tragedy. And who knows, there was a lot of debate as to the cause of that fire. However, without going to that point, since I don't really know, but could it have been prevented? And fire mitigation experts say, yes, that could have been prevented. But it did make us take a look at the expansion of Anchorage to the hillside, the burgeoning building that's going on in that particular area, which, you know, 20 years ago had a handful of houses on it. And now you can see from downtown Anchorage, you can see this huge expanse of population.
Yeah, so taking all of those factors, if we look at Miller's Reach, it was on pretty much flat ground, same forest types as we have here. Wind-driven fire. If we take that scenario and apply it to Anchorage, where we've got limited roads, a lot more people, and slope, which contributes to increased fire spread, put a wind on that fire, and we have that catastrophe. We have the ingredients. So if we say, well, could Miller's Reach have been prevented? Again, we go back to that statement. We can have a wildland urban interface fire without having the associated disaster. Prevention in that case could have been, and I'm not trying to speak for anyone on this, but here's an example. You could have the fire burning through the woods like it's going to do, but homeowners can make their homes defensible. So getting that fuel away from the house. When those burning embers are lofted through the air and they land on the leeward side of the house, and there's something there, a little pile of leaves, and it sits there and festers for a couple minutes or maybe a couple of hours. Firefighters have driven by, house isn't on fire, great, let's move on to the next one. Well, 2 hours later, that might get enough heat in it to actually start the siding on fire. Well, then you've got a structural loss that no one would have known about when they did the initial drive-by. That kind of thing is what we're talking about in FireWise and defensible space, is let's take care of all that little stuff that we don't think about.
Right, and for this period of time, you're saying late April, May, June, July, August, you really have to pay attention. There is rules to living in the forest. I lived in the bush for a long time in a little cabin, and you really had to pay attention to issues that you don't think about at all in a city. Like just walking in and out of your house is full of pitfalls in those areas. Well, we have another phone call coming in. Line 7, Maria?
Yes.
Hi, Maria.
I just turned the radio on and I do not know how much I miss. I do have two huge spruce trees in the backyard. They're away from my home. But they are, in my own assessment, they look very, very dry to me. And I'm sure they've been there for at least 50 years because they're huge. I know when I moved here in 69 that they were there already, but in the past 2 years, they look pretty dry to me. And I don't know, but I'm talking about tall. They are like probably at least 3 stories high.
And you think they're dangerous to your house because they are dead-looking or might burn?
Not
or
to my house. I don't think it would reach my house.
Okay.
But it is in an area. Well, I don't know whether I miss where to call for an assessment, whether they are dangerous, or it's obvious that it's not dangerous because it's far away from my house, but it's still in my yard. I live in an area where we have a lot of land because we have cesspool and we also have our own well. So I have close to an acre.
Maria, are you in Anchorage?
Yes.
You're more than welcome to call our office and we can chat more on the phone. As a rule
of thumb, I would appreciate that if you gave me the number.
Sure. It's 267-4980 is the Wildfire Mitigation Office main phone number.
Okay.
But
and
as
they would check it out and see if it is caused any problem. If not, if I want to remove them, and then at my own cost, then I would do that. But I need, you know, an assessment because this is, you know, I'm a widow, and so, you know, he used to take care of everything.
Well, and you know, it's a good idea to have an assessment, even if your trees turn out that they're not a risk. It's a good idea for education. But to start off, until we talk to you, Maria, I'd recommend watering your trees a little bit if in times of drought like we have kind of right now. We did just get some rain, but you could definitely water your trees, and in the meantime, and then we can chat more about an assessment.
Okay, I really appreciate this. If you give me your number again, I'm sure I didn't have a pencil when you gave it to me.
Okay, it's 267
4980. 4980. I really appreciate this.
Yes, no problem. You're
okay.
Welcome.
Thank you guys for being there. Bye-bye.
Thank you for calling, Maria. And if any other listeners out there have some questions about fire mitigation in their on their property, please give us a call, 550-8433, 550-8433, or 1-888-353-5752, or email us at communityforum@kska.org. Well, I'd like to talk a little more to Jen about, do you have any idea how many homeowners have used the FireWise program over the last couple of years?
Well, since 2002 was the first year that we offered wide-scale FireWise home assessments, and so between 2002 and 2009, we've done 1,491 home assessments.
Wow!
And that's pretty impressive. And then of those 1,491 people, 450 of them have kind of what we see as completing the program. They come through, they submit for the reimbursement that Sue was talking about earlier. So 450 people for a total of $725,000 that we've reimbursed to people for them to basically make their homes more FireWise. And that's in the form of tree removal is what we reimburse for, a partial reimbursement. But yes, definitely, it is quite a lot. There can always be more.
Well, I might be one. I think all my trees are healthy, but and they're not too close to the house. But there is a large, very large, undeveloped area behind my house, and there, you know, who knows what goes on there? If it ever burned down, it would severely impact me and my lifestyle. So we have a call coming in from Susan on line 6. Hello, Susan.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I have a very tall dead spruce tree next to my house, but it's on a city right-of-way. So I don't know what to do with it.
There is, it'd be great if you knew which right-of-way it was, but recognizing that that can be kind of a challenging problem. There is a really wonderful resource that the city developed here a few years ago. On the city website, there is a kind of an issues place where you can file your issue, like such as this tree on the right-of-way, and give information. And then they call you back, and they find out more about the situation, and they can go check it out. So it's through the municipal website, and I wish I could tell you the exact link right now, but
go to kska.org for all the information about today's program.
There will be I'm sure the municipal homepage has a pretty an obvious link, but www.muni.org is the municipality of Anchorage homepage, and Sue and I both aren't exactly sure what the title of that page is, but I'm almost certain that it's on the homepage. You could find it pretty easily.
Yeah, and then they have a method for how you can track your case number too. It's really effective, and it works great.
So the tree being on city property, it would be just to advise the city that it's there?
Yeah, and then they can do something about it. If it's a hazard tree, like you say, it's dead, they can take care of it from there. Because a lot of times there's so much land, we don't know all of the issues that go on the property.
Right. Okay, thanks, Susan. Thanks for calling
in.
Appreciate it.
Thank you so much for your information. Bye-bye.
Yeah, now we have a couple of minutes left. I'd like to mention that the Wildfire Mitigation Office with the Fire Department of the City of Anchorage does have a number of programs. There'll be crews in Anchorage working in the Campbell Creek Greenbelt area, and later they will be at the Russian Jack Park. Did you mention there was a fire in Russian Jack not too long ago, Jen?
Just about a little over a week ago, there was one in close to the East 6th Avenue side of Russian Jack, but it burned right through a very thick, heavy stand of black spruce, exactly the same forest type from the Piper Fire last year.
Mm-hmm. So that can be, there was some rain this week, but not enough. It has to be a real soak.
Yeah, we need a good soak.
Well, Mother Nature will provide that. And I would also like to say that wildfires are not confined to Alaska. California has a tremendous problem with that now, again, because of the development of communities well into the wildfire-prone areas. And it's becoming an increasing problem around the world. Australia has terrible fires, and a lot of it is just growth, human growth, and human expansion into previously uninhabited areas, whereas we were saying earlier, such as the broken snowshoe fire out on McGrath torched something like 25,000 acres, but nobody lived there. I guess it's time to go. You've been listening to Community Forum. Thanks for listening. I'm Ellen Lockyer. See you next week.
Community Forum is a production of KSKA's News and Public Affairs Department. Opinions expressed are those of the guest, host, and callers, and do not represent the views of KSKA, the licensee, or the underwriters. You can subscribe to free podcasts of Community Forum on our website at kska.org, where you can also find links to additional information on today's topic, including all the websites mentioned on today's show. If you have questions or comments concerning this program, write to us at 3877 University Drive, Anchorage, Alaska, 99508, or email communityforum at kska.org. CD copies can be purchased by calling 550-8400 during regular business hours. This is KSKA, Anchorage.